Whether you're a morning person or a bedtime procrastinator, everyone deserves a mattress that works for their style. And you'll find the best mattress for you at Ashley. The new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley brings you one-of-a-kind body-conforming technology, making every sleep tailored to be your best. The collection also features cool-to-the-touch covers and motion absorption to help minimize sleep disruptions from partners, pets, or kids. Shop the all-new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley, for the love of home.
Welcome to Haunting History, the podcast that reaches back into the past for the events that still haunt us today. Tales of true crime, mystery, and the macabre. And when we're lucky, the stories where history and the people who lived it and the paranormal meet. Now, who doesn't love a good ghost story, right? Welcome back to Haunting History Podcast. I'm your host, Kat.
And I'm Haley.
And this week we are going to talk about Glenn Miller. And I want to ask you if you know who Glenn Miller is, but I know that you know who Glenn Miller is.
I have no idea who Glenn Miller is.
You have a tattoo of his song on your wrist.
Okay, but I don't know anything about him. And that's not my choice. That was for somebody else.
But you do know that he was a singer.
Sure.
Right. No. Come on. Why did you get the tattoo?
Because it was for Papa. It has nothing to do with what I want.
Yes, but what about it for Papa?
It was his favorite song.
Right. So then you think clearly you know who's a song leader. Like, he's a singer.
That's about the extent.
Okay, well, I will explain who he is. Because I don't think even people my age know who Glenn Miller is, for the most part. If you're a history buff and you're listening to this because you like history stories, you know who Glenn Miller is. But if you're not a history buff, I don't think most people do. And I was trying to think of someone I could compare him to. He was a prominent American jazz musician and band leader and composer during the swing era, which the swing era was when people would listen to big band music, where it was an entire orchestra. It was a singer, a band leader, and, well, not always a singer. The band leader and singer were not always the same. And it's so hard to explain, like, comparable to today. But band music was what everyone listened to in the 20s and 30s, and maybe even a little bit before. And I wanted to think of, like, a comparable musician today. And I can't say Taylor Swift because I think she's breaking every
record. Now there's production crews and people that create the music, though. So I don't think you can compare.
Well, I was trying to...
Companies that do that.
I was trying to compare the popularity is what I meant.
Got it.
Like, Taylor Swift is I think she's broken
multiple
every
generational type
right.
thing.
So big band music was more like, I guess, like the Rolling Stones, probably not like the Beatles, but where people would scream and yell when the band leader came on. They'd be super excited. It wasn't like a teenage thing, though, although they did listen to big band music, but it was people would pay tons of money to go see Glenn Miller perform with his band. And back in those days, instead of going to concerts, you would go to dances. So, like, wherever he was performing, you would go to dance, not just to watch.
Yeah.
Like you do a concert with. And by the way, people are probably more familiar with Frank Sinatra. Frank Sinatra started as a singer for a big band.
Mm-hmm.
So that's more comparable, I guess. But Glenn Miller was a prominent American jazz musician, band leader, and composer during the swing era. He was born on March 1st, 1904, in Clarinda, Iowa, to parents Mattie Lou Cavender Miller and Louis Elmer Miller. Alton Glenn Miller, Glenn with one N. He actually changed the spelling of his name. His name is spelled now G-L-E-N-N. When he was born, it was just G-L-E-N. He changed the spelling to two N's in high school and started going by Glenn rather than Alton, which was his first name. He hated it. He despised his first name. The only time Alton was on anything was for his military or legal documents. I tried to find where the name Alton came from, you know, so of course, because I went to his family tree, kind of assuming that I would find it as a surname in his family tree, but I didn't. But what I did find, which has nothing whatsoever to do with the story, is that he's a direct descendant of Captain Miles Standish of the Mayflower. You're just looking at me blankly because you don't care about family trees. But Captain Miles Standish, on the Mayflower was one of our founding, you know what I mean? He found like, the Mayflower. That's a big deal to be a direct descendant of someone from the Mayflower. I also found that his son had passed away as recently as 2012. He had a daughter also, but I really can't find any information about her. Glenn showed an early interest in music, learning to play instruments as a child. He started out playing the mandolin, but quickly switched to the horn, which is the basis of jazz musician, is the horn. In high school, in Fort Morgan, Colorado, he played in the school band and was head of the school yearbook. But he wasn't the greatest student. His heart was in music. Like, he lived and died for his jazz music. He missed his own graduation because of an audition. He turned professional after graduating in 1921 and became a member of the Boyd Center's orchestra, but quit in 1923 to go to college. He spent 3 semesters at the University of Colorado before dropping out to return to the music business. And the reason we're talking about him, I know that I probably should have said this from the beginning, is that his disappearance is quite controversial. There's a whole ton of conspiracy theories about Glenn Miller's disappearance, much like Amelia Earhart's disappearance. His journey in the world of music really began in the late 1920s when he played in various bands and orchestras. He gained valuable experience performing with notable musicians such as Benny Goodman and Tommy Dorsey, which those were the other big band orchestras that were out that everybody, you know, was dying to go see. After a small amount of success in 1928, Glenn brought his college girlfriend Helen Berger to New York and they married. It said she played a part in his success and their story was a true love story. In the book Glenn Miller and His Orchestra, author George T. Simon credits Helen with being able to recognize Glenn's various and varying moods and knowing how to deal with them without ever deflating his ego. He was very ego-driven, which I don't think is that different of any musician nowadays, or any artist, really, right?
Right.
She was a master of tact and diplomacy, and especially good at explaining Glenn's actions to others, but without ever demeaning her own husband. In the mid-30s, he formed his own band, but initially struggled to find success. In 1934, Miller became the music director for Tommy Dorsey's band, with brother Jimmy Dorsey. He then formed an American orchestra for British band leader Ray Noble. It wasn't until the late 1930s that the Glenn Miller Orchestra rose to fame, becoming one of the most popular bands of the swing era. And for many of you that don't know who Glenn Miller is, his popularity was equivalent, this is what I wrote, with Rolling Stones and NSYNC during their time. Big band or dance band music was the most popular kind of music in the 30s and 40s. It's hard to imagine now, but back then, getting dressed up and going dancing was a thing to do. I guess people do that now, but, you know, like now you go to nightclubs, like individually. Do you know what I mean?
To go see DJs.
To go see DJs or whatever. But back then you got dressed to the nines and you would go dancing as couples.
You don't even get dressed up to go out in Vegas anymore.
No, not really, right?
No, girls are wearing like sneakers to the clubs in Vegas, which is like way smarter, but right. It's not even, no one gets dressed up to go anywhere anymore.
Yeah, see, girls wore dresses and heels and gloves and hats. Men wore suits to nightclubs. And they were called nightclubs even back then. But it was to dance in front of a live band, a large band. The Glenn Miller Orchestra was just that, an orchestra with upwards of 30 members. And it was just a different time. Miller scored his first hit with Wishing Will Make It So that same year. He penned his even bigger successful single, and this is one you know. Do you know the name of the song that you have on your wrist? We should probably explain what that is.
Moonlight Serenade.
Good job. See, you do Thanks. Know the song. So Moonlight Serenade was one of my dad's favorite songs, which Haley, my sister, and I all have when my dad passed away. We had the first 4 bars of the song tattooed. Haley and I both have it on our wrist. It was a song that became one of his most popular, and it climbed up the charts in 1939. And I should say my dad wasn't old enough to have really been a Glenn Miller fan. My dad was more like the 60s and 70s, really, like when he would have been really listening to music, late 50s, early 60s. But my dad comes from a family of 10 kids, and he was the second to youngest. So his older brothers were 12 and 14 years older than him. So they all grew up listening to big band music. So my dad kind of just listen to what his siblings listen to.
Yeah.
And that song, Moonlight Serenade, and if you get a chance, Google it. Google Glenn Miller Moonlight Serenade. There's videos on YouTube. It's one of the best songs. I think it's one of the prettiest songs I've ever heard. And it's a song that my dad always said was his favorite song. So that's why we got that tattooed on our wrist. Miller Nose Orchestra became the country's top dance band. They dominated the charts with such tracks as In the Mood, Tuxedo Junction, and Pennsylvania 65,000, which, again, I highly recommend you listen to. If you don't know what big band music is, if you get a chance, Google Glenn Miller and listen to Moonlight Serenade, In the Mood, and Pennsylvania 65,000. They were their top hits in 1940, and I think that if you listen to them, you'll understand why it was such a big deal back then. It was like the perfect music that people would go listen to. In 1941, the band ventured into another medium film. First came the film Sun Valley Serenade, starring Norwegian skating star Sonja Henie as a foreign refugee adopted by a band led by Ted Scott, played by John Payne. The band performs throughout the film and accompanies numbers by Dorothy Dandridge and a gravity-defying dance routine by the Nicholas Brothers. I've actually seen that. It's really good. A second film, Orchestra Wives, about a young woman marrying a trumpet player, which is what he was, and the difficulties they faced, followed in 1942. Along with Ann Rutherford, Orchestra Wives featured George Montgomery and Cesar Romero, who both joined the armed forces before the war was over. The band's foray into film, constant touring, and radio programs lifted their music to the top of the charts. As the nation began to gear up for the war and men were drafted through the Selective Service Program, the orchestra began to tour military installations. In 1941, Miller started a radio program called Glenn Miller Sunset Serenade. He used serenade for a lot of things. 5 military installations were selected. It's so weird to think of what it was like during World War II when you really think about it. People didn't have TVs. All their news came from the radio. All their entertainment came from the radio. So people would go, you know, Tuesday nights at 6 o'clock or 8 o'clock or whatever and listen to Glenn Miller Sunset Serenade. And in that show, 5 military installations were selected each week to participate. Each installation would choose a favorite song, which the orchestra would play on that week's program. The public audience would then vote in to vote for their favorite of the 5. So, I mean, that's how people lived. Like, you listen to the radio and wrote into the radio, and I don't know, it's kind of cool.
Nice, yeah, honestly. Right?
Sort of unplugged. We don't understand that nowadays. The installation that had the winning selection won a new RCA radio phonograph and 50 recordings. Miller paid for this himself at an estimated cost of $1,000 a week. So he paid for all the military installations to get his music and be able to use it during the war. By the way, during the most successful years, Glenn was making $15,000 to $20,000 a week.
Dang. That's a lot of money back then.
1941. For those of you who don't think
that's a lot of money now.
I know. And I'm saying if you don't think that sounds super impressive, which you obviously thought $15,000 to $20,000 a week. But like if you Google the cast members of Vanderpump Rules and see how much they make an episode, is $25,000 or $30,000 an episode or whatever.
Sure, but only when they're filming. This guy was making it year-round, right? Yeah,
a week. And it's just to like clarify what that sounds like, of $1,936 has equivalent purchasing power of $423,000 a week.
That's insane.
So that'd be if someone was making $423,000. But that goes to show how popular big band music was.
Yeah, that's wild.
Like, we don't have a frame of reference for it. Do you know what I mean? For the patriotic Miller at the height of his success, paying that $1,000 a week for the different military bases to get his 50 recordings when they won for picking the most favorite song,
That was nothing.
It was a small price for him to pay. Yeah. He was very supportive of the American Armed Forces. So, like, I mean, clearly, when you're making $423,000 a week, well, the equivalency of that, he was making $20,000. It probably wasn't a big deal to spend $4,000 a month, right?
No.
Despite being at the height of his musical career, he felt a strong sense of duty to serve his country. In the summer of 42, despite several radio contracts renewing and new opportunities coming his way pretty much every day, Miller applied for a U.S. Navy commission. The Navy rejected his application. Undeterred, Miller quickly offered his services to the U.S. Army, which was all too happy to offer him a commission. During a rehearsal for the Chesterfield program, which, by the way, Chesterfield was a cigarette brand, and they sponsored many of the radio programs. You know how now we have commercials between
everything?
Yeah. Back then, programs were sponsored by different brands, and Chesterfield Cigarettes was one of the biggest sponsors. Can you imagine that now?
No.
No. He asked that everyone but the band leave the studio. He had news. Miller was breaking up his band to accept a commission with the U.S. Army. America's favorite band leader was to become Captain Glenn Miller, U.S. Army. Reporting for duty on October 7th of 1942, Miller received his formal commission as a captain in November. He was transferred from the U.S. Army to the U.S. Army Air Forces and assigned to Maxwell Field, Alabama. By 1943, Miller was named the Director of Bands Training for the Army Air Forces Technical Training Command and moved to the USAAF Basic Training Station No. 2 in Atlantic City, New Jersey. As Director of Bands, Miller began to recruit. Any civilian who wanted to play for him in the Army Air Forces simply had to write him a letter of intent and give him details on their own skills. That's how he auditioned people. Upon enlistment, Miller could request almost any man he wanted and have them pulled from his unit. Several of the musicians who played with Miller in civilian life followed him into uniform and joined the band again. He persuaded General Henry Arnold to allow him to take a 50-piece band to England to play for the troops. This group was quickly known as Glenn Miller's Band. 1943 took Miller to New York City, where he was assigned to Yale University to set up a radio production unit and concert orchestra. This Army Air Forces band was larger than any Miller had led before joining. He was able to mix smaller elements into the group, and he could play dance and jazz numbers, broadening what his orchestra could offer audiences. Never one to focus on one outlet at a time, during 1943, Miller and his orchestra toured the U.S., contributed to the Office of War Information Recordings by recording Uncle Sam Presents for use by American forces in Music from America, which targeted foreign audiences. A larger project was I Sustain the Wings, a program of music and sketches detailing Army Air Force units, job specialties, and more, in hopes of obtaining recruits. Appearance by the band at bond drives easily netted upwards of $4 million in pledge in a single night. Talk about a draw.
Yeah.
Taylor Swift could probably do that now. Beyonce could probably do that now. But back in 1943, he could raise $4 million in one night just by performing.
Which is crazy with not having social media outreach, all of the things that we have now.
Right. Like, how did they even find out that his band was playing somewhere?
Yeah.
He remained as popular as ever with the civilian population, but Miller was not satisfied. He wanted to play in person for troops overseas. Miller flew to England while his 60-plus member organization took the slow route on board the RMS Queen Elizabeth.
Whether you're a morning person or a bedtime procrastinator, everyone deserves a mattress that works for their style. And you'll find the best mattress for you at Ashley. The new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley brings you one-of-a-kind body-conforming technology, making every sleep tailored to be your best. The collection also features cool-to-the-touch covers and motion absorption to help minimize sleep disruptions from partners, pets, or kids. Shop the all-new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley, for the love of home.
Elizabeth. They finally arrived in London in late of June 1944. The timing was disastrous. On June 13th, German forces began to launch the first of their retribution weapons, the V-1 flying bomb, nicknamed Doodlebugs. The F-1 was a one-ton bomb built into a winged aircraft powered by a pulse jet engine. V-1s rained down on the already blitz-destroyed London for months in 1944. Miller quickly tired of the threat and moved his band 50 miles north to Bedford on Sunday, July 2nd. The next day, a V-1 landed in the street in front of the quarters where the band had evacuated the day before. It killed over 60 American servicemen. So he got his band out of there literally the day before. And they all would have, none of them would have survived probably. Miller's band was scheduled for a performance in Paris on Christmas Eve 1944. Miller was eager to get there ahead of the band to make arrangements. There had been difficulty coordinating lodgings and other spaces required for the more than 60-member organization, and he was ordered to Paris himself to finish the work. Again, Miller faced difficulty. The weather was terrible, cold and foggy. Regular transportation flights were canceled, and Miller was getting antsy. The band was scheduled to fly to Paris in just days, and Miller had to arrive before to firm up their plans. I mean, it's not like now where you can just go online and book everything, right?
Yeah.
He had to get there. Celebrities like Miller were required to have all air transportation formally approved. but Miller was too focused on the task at hand to worry about military bureaucracy. When he ran into his friend, Lieutenant Colonel Norman Basil, who offered him a seat on a flight to Paris on December 15th, he didn't hesitate. Although it was well known that Glenn hated to fly, especially in small planes, he had a job to do. Bad weather continued on the 15th, but when a UC-64A Norseman landed at Twinwood Farm Airfield just before 2 p.m., Miller and Basil boarded that plane. It's important to note that here that although a rugged plane, the Norseman was a 10-place single-engine utility transport whose carburetor was known to freeze over. The day they flew out, the temperature was 34 degrees, which is literally just above freezing, and the pilot was not well-versed in instrument flying, which I don't know that I would get on a plane with anybody who didn't know how to fly, because you never know what the weather's going to do, right?
You would barely get on a plane with anybody anyway.
I would, yeah, I'm not going to hurry to get on any plane, to be honest. Piloted by Flight Officer John R. Stewart Morgan, the plane had to be flown below the cloud cover, which was anywhere from 1,500 to 3,000 feet, which is, I could fly all day at that.
I was going to say, that seems low.
Yeah, it's when the pilot comes on and says we've reached 36,000 feet that I literally lose my shit. Like, I don't want to know how freaking high we are. It was not an ideal day for a flight. And since he had never gotten approval to leave, so that's the thing. He was a celebrity in the Army. He had to get approval to fly anywhere. And he didn't bother because he had to get to Paris. He didn't want to wait for bureaucracy. And we all know how long everything takes. So he or Basil actually never got approval to leave, fly, or be on a plane, which meant that they were not officially recorded on any manifest for the flight. On December 18th, the band finally arrived in Paris, landing in Orly Airport. The band was quickly confused and concerned when Miller was not there to meet them at the airport. Headquarters was contacted to locate him, but they were unaware he had even flown to Paris. Like I said, he wasn't on any of the manifests. He did not get approval. Investigations led to a missing air crew report filed on the 18th. It was for the missing Norseman flown by Flight Officer Morgan. Since Basil and Miller had taken the flight without clearing any of the proper channels, they weren't listed on the report. Miller's administrative officer, Lieutenant Don Haynes, had driven the pair to the airfield and realized a horrific truth. Miller's administrative officer, Lieutenant Don Haynes, had driven the pair to the airfield and realized the horrific truth. Miller and Basil were both missing. The band was scheduled to perform on Christmas Day, but no official word had gone out about Miller's disappearance. Pre-recorded programs were still being played, and outside of the band and Army headquarters, few knew he was even gone. On Christmas Eve in 1944, the world learned that Major Glenn Miller was missing in action. The band's mission was too important to stop, even with the loss of their beloved leader, so they played on. A side note that I think is pretty impressive is that between mid-June and early December of 1944, Glenn Miller's band gave 300 live performances in England, as well as 500 radio broadcasts to Allied troops. Multiple aircraft and ships were deployed to scour the English Channel and the surrounding areas. However, despite intense efforts, no wreckage or evidence of the plane was found. The search was eventually called off, and Glenn Miller was declared missing in action. The exact details of what happened to the plane, Glenn Miller, the pilot, and his friend remain unclear to this day, and the circumstances surrounding his disappearance have fueled various theories and speculations. And since there was no wreckage ever located, it left the mystery of Glenn Miller's disappearance unresolved. In January of 1945, the U.S. War Department officially declared Glenn Miller presumed dead. Several theories have been proposed over the years. Some suggest the aircraft may have encountered mechanical issues, while others propose the possibility of friendly fire or that the plane was mistaken for an enemy aircraft and shot down. The official conclusion reached by the United States Army Air Force was that due to limited visibility, military aircraft of that era, including the UC-64 Air Norseman, was plagued with faulty engine carburetors. This, combined with wings prone to icing over in sub-freezing temperatures, sealed the fate of that aircraft. As the airplane ventured over the water, the cloud ceiling descended, and with temperatures at freezing, the engine succumbed to icing. Suddenly, beyond the midpoint of the channel, the engine ceased to function, causing the plane to nosedive into the channel. Another theory that's more widely accepted is that the plane Miller was flying in was destroyed by friendly fire, which I don't think the Army would ever admit to. It was discovered that 138 planes were reported returning from an aborted Allies bombing raid, disposed of their bombs over the English Channel. They had to get rid of the bombs coming back. They couldn't.
And what, accidentally hit his plane?
The theory is that one hit Miller's plane, causing it to crash. A British airman named Fred Shaw claimed that he saw Miller's plane crash into the English Channel. Shaw was part of that fleet of the 138 British Lancaster planes en route to Germany that day for the planned bombing raid. Their mission was aborted due to poor weather, obviously the same weather that affected Glenn Miller's plane. Since landing an aircraft laden with live explosives was deemed extremely risky, the flights were all ordered to do a 10-mile circle of the English Channel to safely drop their collective 100,000 bombs. I've never seen bombs exploding from a plane before, Shaw recalled. I put my head in a little observation blister where I could look vertically down. There, sure enough, 4,000-pound cookies were exploding, and I could see the blast waves were radiating outward. As I watched, the bomb aimer said, "There's a kite down there." And I looked down and saw a small, tiny, high-wing monoplane. I saw him flip over to port. It looked like he was going into a spin. He dived in and splashed. Then he disappeared under the wing. After viewing a Glenn Miller biopic a decade later, Shaw felt compelled to check his logbook to see if the date of the bomb dump corresponded to the day Miller missing, and it did, down actually to the hour. Shaw's flight captain, Victory Gregory, also recalled that Shaw and two others on the flight had reported a down plane over their intercoms. A logbook belonging to RAF or RAF flight engineer Derek Thurman, which was put up for auction in 2000, contains similar notes of an unexpected plane in the area. Nobody anticipated that there was an aircraft there at all, Thurman told the BBC. There was a shout that there was someone there. The navigator shot out of his seat to look and saw it whip by. Then the rear gunner said, "It's gone in," flipped over and gone in. Though the portion of the channel known as the South Jettison Zone was deemed a no-fly zone for unauthorized flights, Thurman theorized the pilot had become lost in the fog that had foiled the German bombing raid. Whether it was brought down from a blast by the bomb or it was hit is anyone's guess. Yet this theory is contested by Roy Brown, another veteran of the same bombing raid, who says that it would have been impossible for Shaw or anyone else to have witnessed the crash of a light aircraft like the Norseman. Over 100 aircraft were involved, 138 to be exact, an extremely dicey in 910s cloud when we could hardly see our own wingtips. So he's basically saying that guy couldn't have seen anything. Considering that we were jettisoned from an altitude of 3,000 feet with absolutely nil visibility, in my opinion, it's a ridiculous claim from any observer. Another theory is that Glenn Miller was an orchestra leader by day and a spy by night. This is sort of the most unbelievable one, but you know someone's got to go there, right? They believe that he was working for the United States government and using his position as a famous and well-respected entertainer to glean information about the German war machine. Citing his connection to David Niven, who many claim was working on some aspect for the British government. Some have even expounded on the story, stating that Miller was acting as a diplomat of the United States and had embarked on a highly classified liaison with the Germans to discuss peace agreement when he was captured and killed by Germans. I kind of don't believe that one.
No, I think the other theories make a lot more sense.
Yeah, Glenn Miller's brother has his own theory, which is perhaps the least likely. His name is Herb. He reportedly claimed in 1985 that Glenn never even left England, but died somewhere of cancer. Herb allegedly told the Weekly World News, "I've never believed the story that my brother died in a plane crash. The accident, he claimed, was concocted to provide the swing stars with a hero's death rather than one in a lousy bed." In Herb's version of events, Miller, a heavy smoker, allegedly wrote to him in the summer of 44, complaining of poor health. "I am totally emancipated, although I'm eating enough," he allegedly said. "I have trouble breathing. I think I'm very ill." There is circumstantial evidence that Miller was indeed unwell during this period. Don Haynes later admitted that Miller had lost a great deal of weight, and his British radio director recalls him saying, "You know, George, I have an awful feeling you guys are going to go home without me." Herb died in 1907 before he could clear up the holes in his story. I mean, can you imagine the whole plane thing being concocted just to make him look like he died a hero?
No.
And did he die a hero?
No.
If he was accidentally bombed?
Yeah.
I mean, he was a hero for joining the war and doing all that he did, but that's not...
Yeah, that's not a heroic storyline.
Right. In 1987, trawling in the English Channel, an English fisherman pulled up an airplane wreck that he later realized looked like the kind of plane that Glenn Miller disappeared in. He called the Coast Guard and described it. And they said, well, if it's a World War II plane, it might be a war grave. Just get rid of it. Which is crazy that they would do that. And as recently as May of 23, they're still searching for that Norseman plane. Dr. James DeAngelo is heading up a team to find Miller's plane. He believes new research and new technology can help find the plane where others have failed. Would that unequivocally determine the fate of Glenn Miller? No, not really. We may never know even if they find the plane. We may never know even if they find the plane what happened that day. Much of it would be destroyed by now. But it would put to rest all the theories of him not dying in a plane that day. It wouldn't tell us if it was caused by weather or friendly fire, though. Today, there is a Glenn Miller Museum at the Twinwood Airfield that his plane took off from that day. The museum contains a restored control room overlooking the airfield, raft displays, an aviation art exhibit, and a room dedicated to Glenn Miller and his music. Ghost investigations of the airfield and the restored control room have had some pretty spooky incidents. Whether it's a ghost of Glenn Miller remains to be seen. What do you think happened to him?
I think either of the plane theories make sense.
That friendly
either
fire
bombed or
weather.
Weather, yeah. Right.
It's just so many things like went into that day. Like it's the same thing with any kind of controversy. Like, why did he not get approval to go where he would be on a manifest? Do you know what I'm saying? Like, all these things lined up to have the consequences of the conspiracy theories today.
Right. Yeah.
But that's with everything, right?
Yeah.
The legacy of Glenn Miller endures through his timeless music, including hits like Moonlight Serenade and Chattanooga Choo Choo. His contributions to the big band and swing music genres continue to influence musicians today. While the circumstances of his death remain a mystery, Glenn Miller's impact on the world of music is undeniable. Thank you for listening to this episode of Haunting History Podcast. We love hearing from you, so be sure to like, follow, and comment on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at Haunting History Podcast. And don't forget to subscribe, rate, and review wherever you listen to all your favorites.
Visit our website at hauntinghistorypodcast.com for more information on each episode, links to our Patreon page, and all of our social media platforms.
Until next time, I'm Kat.
I'm Haley.
Remember, the living are far scarier than any ghost.
The living room is where you make life's most beautiful memories. But your sofa shouldn't be the one remembering them. The new life-resistant, high-performance furniture collection from Ashley is designed to withstand all the spills, slip-ups, and muddy paws that come with the best parts of life. Ashley high-performance sofas and recliners are soft, on-trend, and easy to clean. Shop the high-performance furniture in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley, for the love of home.